from this room, then a couple online, and we'll go back and forth as time permits. So let's begin. Where is the mic? Who has the mic? There's the mic. Is there a question here? Oh, here. I'm sorry. I didn't see.
Thank you, Ms. President. Just wondering if you'd be willing to speak for just a second about Obama's declaration to work towards ending nuclear weapons around the world. Apparently, this morning he sat on the Security Council and made that announcement for the first time in the history of the country. It's not particularly relevant to what you've been saying, but...
will you tell us who you are? Are you a student?
At the college.
Yeah, thanks.
I haven't read Obama's declaration this morning because I've been working on my speech. So I'm not sure exactly what he said, but I think that for all of us, any advance towards containing, controlling nuclear weapons is obviously an essential part of building a future that is sustainable for us and the planet. So I'm glad to hear that this has occurred. Thank you. Here's a question. Yes.
Dear President Forrest, thank you for giving me the opportunity to meet you here. I'm a visiting scholar of the English Department of Harvard University. The issue I focus on is the roles of university. I know you have ever given your proposition. The essence of a university is that it is uniquely accountable to the past and to the future, not simply or even primarily to the present. A university looks both backwards and forwards in ways that must conflict with the public's immediate concerns or commands. I fully agree with your point of view. However, I have two questions on this to ask you. Today is a globalization times, and it is a postmodern times. Most people pay more and more attention to the present, but seldom to the past or to the future. When you proposed your point, have you ever encountered any challenges? In addition, as the president of Harvard, how did you balance relationship between Harvard's responsibilities for the past, present, and the future? And what measures have you taken to balance it? Thank you.
And what was the last phrase? What measures have I taken? Was that the last part?
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Well, it's very flattering to be quoted to yourself. Thank you. The question is about universities as uniquely obligated to both the present and the future, and not about simply the bottom line in the next quarter. How I've come, those are words that I uttered in my installation address about 2 years ago. And as I think about how they've resonated for me over the past year in particular, the balancing of the present with our obligations to the future. That's at the heart, just to be very concrete. That's what endowment planning's about. That's about how we manage to grapple with the challenges of today and continue to invest in today, at the same time sustaining Harvard for the long term, for the generations that will come after us. So that's one aspect of it. I'd say another aspect of it is, as we see a world in such enormous turmoil, confronting problems that a year ago we had not, or a little more than a year ago, we had not imagined. I think we see a different way in which universities dual allegiance to the present and the past, or triple allegiance to the present, the past, and the future plays out. And that is, we're the ones who need to ask the big questions, to raise people's sights beyond what they may be doing in any one particular moment. Increasing risk, ignoring the impact of policies. And we've got to say, what are the big ethical questions? What are the big historical questions? What are the economic implications of what's going on? That's why universities matter so much, because we're a little removed from the daily bustle of life. We have an enormous impact on it, but we also transcend it. And I think in the past year, we've seen this more forcefully than ever before. Another question. Oh, I'm supposed to do the online now. Do we have an online question? Thank you. This is a question from someone in the Harvard College class of 72, an alum, who asks, what impact will the current financial crunch have upon the size of the student populations in the various schools? That, of course, varies from school to school, and it's something that the schools have been looking at quite closely. One of the foremost things to say is that the size of the college at this present time is not going to change because it is limited. I'm looking, I think that's the dean over there. In the dark, I see him. And he and I, Mike Smith and I, have talked about this a lot. The size of the college now is really limited by the residential college system and the number of students we can house, so that we have absolutely no intention of changing the numbers of students in the college. Some of the graduate and professional schools, however, have been looking at what seem like appropriate sizes for them. We've seen a lot of demand on the part of individuals to come to school again, to come back and get graduate training. And so some of our schools found that their yields increased this fall. I believe there's a very large class, for example, at the Graduate School of Design because so many people accepted offers and wanted to come back to graduate school. The business school was asking some questions last winter about should they grow a bit to accommodate demand. So I think a number of our schools are asking themselves what their appropriate size is, and they may adjust based on the quality of the student body and the level of demand for places in the schools. So we may see some adjustments in our graduate and professional schools. Should I do a second one here? All right. This is from an employee in human resources who says, is there a formal mechanism through which employees or departments can suggest improvements and efficiencies in the way Harvard is run? The answer to that is there ought to be. I know that a number of schools have such websites. I believe there's one in FAS and some of the other schools. And so why don't we start one right now? If you have an idea for, more generally for the university as a whole, send it to president@harvard.edu. And if we want to set up something more website-like, we can see if that makes sense. But for the moment, how about that as an answer? Now why don't we go to the floor and see. Is that Diana? Yes.
Thank you, President Faust, for these visions of how we might all work together. And it really is sparking ideas. I've struggled for years about how those of us in FAS and Bill Graham in the Divinity School and all of us might create mm-hmm. a more robust, unified program in religious studies Great. Across the university that might even involve people from the Kennedy School. And my question is, how much power do you have? Do you have the kind of power that is coercive, or that is largely moral or visionary? I mean, how do we bring these things about? Because those of us who have been around here a long time know how hard it is to break the boundaries.
I agree. One of the issues about my power is it's not all that clearly defined in many areas. And so it's an ongoing set of challenges. I mean, there's certain things that we might think about doing that we haven't thought about doing before, and so no one knows whether the president's allowed to do them or not. I think if there are things that make sense to us and we want to do them, let's get them done, and let's figure out where the power lies or doesn't lie, and let's do them. There are certain areas, obviously, in which my power is very clearly defined. Faculty matters, curriculum matters are very importantly lodged in faculty deliberation and decision-making. But I hope that I can push and pull and lead and tug and bribe and various other things in those areas as well. Thank you. Everyone likes it that that's an unanswerable question, isn't it? Yes.
How do you do, Madam President? On that stage right where you're standing, when I was 15 years old, I performed as a student at the St. Joseph Community School. And that performance got me into Milton Academy. ultimately, I came back here to the Extension School from which I'm honored to have graduated. I'm back getting a master's degree now. But I'm not speaking for myself. I'm speaking for the organization I now chair, the Boston Learning Center, which works with K through 12 kids, teaching after-school learning programs that Harvard has now studied and told us we've discovered something called sustainable motivation. This is not a commercial. What the university may be suffering in a shortfall, with all due respect, may turn out to be a boon in the goodwill from organizations in the community like ours, which would welcome the opportunity to work with you. And we need tutors, and we need all the resources of this university. That's not financial. That's a plea for help. Thank you.
Thank you for saying that. I think it's so important in these times for us to recognize our strong ties to our neighbors in Cambridge and Boston, the ways our students and faculty are engaged in those communities, and the kinds of intersections that can matter so much to those communities and to us. So thank you for saying that. I've been unfairly focused on this side of the stage. Is there some other voices? How about over here?
President Faust, as a doctoral student in FAS in the humanities, what draws me here is, in the end, the faculty. As excited as I am by the plans for Alston and other kind of bricks and mortar investment, can you talk a little bit from your vantage point how you think about replacing retiring faculty and those kinds of decisions as opposed to kind of capital investment?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think if you look at the way we've made the decision or approached the decision about the stem cell department and the issues concerning their future, we decided that while we looked at the options of making the science project in Alston more affordable, we had to take care of the scientists and their research. And so that will not be interrupted. That was a prioritization of people and programs and research over bricks and mortar, to say what matters is what goes on in our heads, what goes on between us, what goes on in laboratories, not any particular location for that. So your question about renewing faculty, I mentioned at the very beginning of my remarks that we have 70 new ladder faculty across the university this year. And I said that because there's been so much talk about hiring freezes or determinations that we wouldn't replace faculty. I think we all recognize in every school that renewing the faculty, bringing in young minds, bringing in new minds, bringing in distinguished scholars at every stage are significant necessities for our academic and intellectual life and for our distinction and our aspirations. And so we have to look very hard at how we decide which areas to hire in, which areas have priority. We can't do everything in these circumstances. We can't ignore the kinds of constraints we face. But this is, for all the deans in every school, an extremely important priority within the analysis of where we stand. Here's one up here.
As a student studying global health, I was very encouraged to hear that you've made it a priority of this university. And I was also encouraged to hear that we must measure our success of our research and education based on our impact on the human condition and human welfare. However, our research and medical technologies must be made accessible to poor people in poor countries in order to have an actually tangible impact. What measures will Harvard take to make the fruits of our scientific research accessible to those who need it most?
We've been working with the group I'm guessing you belong to in that domain, and the Provost Steve Hyman, I know, has worked very closely with you to promote policies that will spread our scientific research more actively and more rapidly to those in the developing world. So I think this is something that we have acknowledged is of great importance and something we'll continue to work on. Let me try another one from, should I just go on with the ones you already got, or you want to have some new and exciting ones? Oh, this has several questions? Oh, okay. So look. This is from a Harvard Business School alum in the class of '88 that says, how can we alumni help? Certainly donating where we can and upholding the standards and teaching of Harvard in our chosen professions. How can we help the Harvard community during these changes? Well, first of all, sending this in is great. The fact that that's a good beginning. The fact that you are concerned, that you see that we are not just a community of people on this campus and on the Longwood campus, but rather we are a community that extends well beyond this geographic location into the world and the areas that surround us. I think that is extraordinarily important for us to keep our eyes on the long term, to notice with alumni how Harvard has changed one way and another over the years that they remember, and how we're going to be able to adapt. So a sense of our history, a sense of commitment, and the variety of ways in which alumni involve themselves in serving the university, from interviewing prospective students to making ties in the community. We are grateful for all of those. My eye keeps going over there. I keep thinking it's unfair to let every single person on that side of the room ask a question. We'll go here.
I'm a student of the Graduate School of Education. I just graduated from Peking University this year. This month in the Graduate School of Education, it's far more than I expected. And then I think in our school, in Peking University, we have programs offered by other outstanding American schools like Yale and Stanford. They offer programs which bring their professors and students to China to study and work with Chinese students and professors too. I wonder if Harvard has such plans to impact the world.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed very much visiting Peking University last year. The question is about the nature of our global engagement. And I think it's a very terrific question because we have worked hard in recent years to extend our engagement across the world, both through opportunities for students and also opportunities for research and involvement by faculty. So there are a variety of ways in which our faculty is involved in Chinese universities and universities in every continent. And so this is something that we do and will continue to build on. Other questions? Anybody? Let me see. Do you have one? Someone here? Yes.
Hi there. My name is Vince Eckert. I'm a senior at the college. At the beginning of your speech, you kind of suggested that shades of color don't matter, and I'm not sure I agree with that. But what I was wondering was what the future of the arts are at the university, or what you thought they were.
Maybe I should make my point about shades of color more clear. If the right to choose among 30 shades of crimson for your business card costs us money that we could be investing in scholarships or faculty support, I think we should settle for fewer shades of crimson and more scholarships and faculty support. On the question of the arts, as you know, we had a task force that reported last fall on opportunities for expanding the presence of the arts on campus and making them more central to the cognitive life of the university. We've begun to act on a number of those recommendations. We have a whole series of courses in the general with art making as part of them in the general education curriculum, number of freshman seminars involving art making, plans to bring in some marvelous visiting artists, more access for students to artistic opportunities in the area. We'll be forming a committee to oversee the arts at Harvard. Lots of kinds of progress that we're very pleased to have made in spite of the changed financial circumstances from the time the task force began to work until the time it reported on its findings. So this is a high priority. It's one that we hope to highlight. We're delighted this fall to have Diane Paulus opening a very vibrant first season at the ART, and we think that's energized the dramatic arts on campus, and we'll hope to continue up on that path. So if we don't have lots of shades on our business cards, we'll hope to compensate by having lots of artistic experiences all over the campus.
Oh.
Are there others on the floor? Should I go back to these? Maybe one more? Do we want to do one more? Anybody? Here's somebody in a white t-shirt up here. Is that Bonnie? Is that you? I just called on a crimson reporter.
Hi, my name is Bonnie Cavusi. I'm a student at the college and a reporter for the Crimson. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how Harvard in particular got into this financial situation and what we might be doing to try to prevent, I guess, future crises in terms of investments into operations expenses.
In the early 90s, we and a number of our peer institutions began investing not so much in stocks and bonds as had been traditional, but in some what were called alternative investment classes that have proved to be very, very successful for us. And those alternative investment classes produce very large returns for us, for Yale, for Princeton, for Stanford. And we began to see the proportion of our budget that came from endowment grow in its size over time, so that we are now well into the 35% range of our dependence on endowment. So this was all a very fine story. And then some aspects of those investments were shown to be in an unanticipated way, or shown to have consequences that people really hadn't anticipated. And that was a result of the global meltdown last year. I think we've learned a number of things. One of the things we've learned is that on balance, this was still a good set of choices. If we look at our endowment growth from the early or over the last 10 years and compare it to what it would have been if we'd invested in a traditional mix of stocks and bonds, our average over the last 10 years, this includes the last year with our down 27% numbers, our returns are 8.9% over that 10-year period. If we'd invested in the traditional way, our returns would be 1.4%. So on balance, it was still a very good set of decisions. But we have learned from the experience of the last year a number of things about liquidity, about risk, about some of the implications in these kinds of choices that people had not really been aware of before. If you read the end-of-year letter that was published just about 10 days ago by Harvard Management Company, the organization that invests our funds, you'll see a lot of reflection on this and on ways we think about the future after the lessons we've learned in the past year. And so, on balance, this was a good set of choices, but now we have learned some of the aspects of those choices that will enable us to act in a more kind of defensive manner about the downsides of these investments as we go forward. I think I'll stop. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.